Hello, everybody. Welcome to Book Talk. I'm Ryan Van Winkle, your host for this episode, and what a pleasure it is to be here. We're going to be talking today about stories, memory, and histories. I'm really excited to say that we've got Michael Fry on the podcast, the great Scottish novelist and poet Dilys Rose, and Chris Ware, the graphic novelist from America, who's done some incredible things. And he's going to start off the podcast. He's recently done a book called Building Stories, which was a graphic novel done in this very strange format with loads of little mini graphic novels in there, some presented as newspaper print, some as small magazines, some as postcards. Really, really beautifully and elegantly done. And Chris explains the work and his process incredibly well. So it's such a great pleasure to turn you over to him. Here he is, Chris Ware.
My name is Chris Ware, and my most recent book is Building Stories. I wanted to make a book that had no beginning or end to it, that in some way hopefully reflected the way that we both remember things and take our memories and put them back together and take them apart. In very non-linear ways. I hate the word non-linear because that immediately sounds like I'm trying to be pretentious, which I'm not. But the book itself, the story concerns the life of a girl slash woman in her 20s slash 40s living either in a city Chicago apartment or as a married mother in the suburbs of Chicago. And depending on where you decide to start reading or which book you decide to pick up first, you'll either be seeing some of those things as memories or as anticipations of what her life might be, which is something I hope a reflection of how I experienced my own 20s. The whole idea of having a child and being married when I was in my 20s was completely absurd, and I would kind of have this vague idea of what it might be like. Now when I look back that I'm married and have a child, my 20s seem very distant and strange at the same time. So
it's a really intense thing. And what is it about memory and the way people enter memory that interests you, I'm wondering, because so much of your work is influenced by this sort of looking back, looking forward.
It's just because that's all there is. That's all we have. There's nothing else. I mean, that's life. Life is memory. There's no truth anywhere else. It's how we structure our lives. It's how we structure our sense of self. I have a videotape of my grandmother telling a story that I've only watched once because it doesn't sound like her at all. It's not her voice. It's not the voice that I have in my mind of her. But even obviously it is her voice because it's a recording of her. It's actually a videotape of her talking, but it's not the way I remember her. Things change. It happens whenever anybody looks at photographs of themselves or, geez, did I really have hair like that? Or did I really look like that? Or, oh, I thought I was this old during that time. Or was our daughter really ever that young? Or that is literally all we have. That's our memories. And to one degree or another, they're fictions. I mean, we have a sense that time is moving forward or we're moving forward through it, depending on your choice of how you view those things. And there's certainly a beginning and there's certainly an end, but it's not, when you meet somebody, you don't start with, I was born at this time and I attended this or that and I went through this and thought this about myself and go on and on until you finally bring somebody up. You might tell an anecdote about what you had for breakfast or, you know, what happened to you walking somewhere or something like that. And then from that little story and then another anecdote, that person will start to piece together a sense of you, or you'll piece together a sense of that person through the anecdotes that they tell. It just seems to me that's the way we experience life. We put these things back together in a chronology because we have a sense that something is growing, something is changing. The first time someone told a story from beginning to end that created a sense of birth to life, it must have been quite revelatory for the listener. It must have been, oh yeah, that is the way things happen. I never thought of that, you know? So these are models that we place on our consciousness is to make sense of our feelings and our relationships. So.
Yeah, it's about making sense, isn't it? And if you take that structure out, it starts to, but it still hangs together. And this is the amazing thing about this book and the way you've done it. It's all in a box, different formats, different sizes, different textures of, you know, hardcover books to like kind of leaflety types of things. It's very similar to, say, B.S. Johnson's experiment. You know.
Unfortunates, right. It is, and I knew absolutely nothing about that. I'm really, truly sorry to say, especially because the kind of intentional acronym for my book itself, B.S., is kind of a joke because it looks rather pretentious as an object, and the idea is rather pretentious. And I'd never even heard of The Unfortunates until I read one of their first reviews of the book in the British newspaper. And I thought, oh boy, I guess I better get that book. So I do have a copy of it, but I have not read it. So
originally I thought that, and I was like, oh, it must be influenced by that. I was certain of it. But then I started thinking, when I started to read this one, this kind of, what is it, A4 magazine size, roughly, I kind of started to think about comic books in general and comic strips in general, and the notion that, like, nobody starts Calvin and Hobbes from the beginning. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody starts Peanuts or Batman or Superman or Spider-Man from the very beginning. And actually, there's something, do you think that is part of what influenced this decision? Like, it's very natural, I think, in terms of if anybody's read comic books for a long time, to jump in the middle.
Yeah, partly. I mean, I've serialized part of this book in my own periodical as well, which is now a hardcover. I started doing it as a hardcover a few years ago. So it's really not necessarily that different from that. Having it contained within a box in sort of a finite way, I guess, is. But it is. And even some of the great works of literature were serialized and even written as they were published, from Dostoevsky to Dickens. I mean, those are sort of famous examples of things being seen as they're being created or read in pieces. So it's not uncommon way of reading a story. So
yeah, it's not about people watch TV shows, but it seems very revolutionary. Like, it seems very, people seem very surprised that it's like, oh, you can jump in anywhere.
Well, I think there's a sense of the novel, you know, with a heavy brick sensation to it and a capital N, you know, being a finished thing, but it's frequently just a collection of you know, attempts at something and hoping that it holds together. So
when I opened this up, this amazing first panel, it's one page panel where kind of you can read it, you start, there's no starting place, I guess maybe the center, you start in the center, you work your way out in any order you want, but you kind of get this whole thing. And I guess I thought in my head, this has been done and you'd done this in like Billy Corrigan or something, but it actually, when I was flipping through it today, I didn't see this kind of style, and this is really something that's kind of emerged and developed recently in your work. And can you talk about how this started to emerge and develop, this kind of circular style?
Well, again, as the book itself is supposed to not have a beginning or end, a lot of the pages and the structure of the books are designed in such a way that they don't necessarily have a beginning or end. So rather than starting in the upper left-hand corner, as is traditional in a gridded-out comic strip, I would start with the center of the page, because to me that seems like the most obvious core focus of where the energy of a strip is, if that doesn't sound too California of me to say, just by virtue of the colors or the design of the page, that's probably where your eye will fall. Not necessarily you might start in the left or you might go around, but it's hopefully clear to the reader that you could start anywhere and there something is interrelated. And it's the same way that thoughts kind of, you know, they don't necessarily start or end either. And in this case, these are just thoughts that kind of feed on themselves, which is a fairly common state of mind. When one is falling asleep, you keep thinking the same things over and over again, especially if you're not feeling so good about yourself. So,
is there a lot of trial and error in trying to create something that can be read that way, read backwards and forwards? Because it's really, really elegantly, expertly done.
I read everything I'm writing as I do it hundreds of times over and over again to try to get it's like composing music, basically, is what it comes down to. You have a sense of a feeling you're trying to get to, but the second you actually start playing a note or hearing the notes that you're playing, you think, oh, that doesn't sound right, or you think, oh, that sounds kind of better than what I had in mind. So it's a similar kind of process, and I just hope that it's clear. I don't want to be too obscure, though, because then I think it quite possibly loses the reader. The book itself starts in the very beginning of a day and ends at the end of a day. It's supposed to represent the thoughts and experiences generally of this character in her life, in her 20s, living in the apartment building. It's very hard to capture this particular, the sense of the every day I would go and do this sort of thing, or I would take a shower at this time. And I'm trying to get at a sense of that sort of general continual events, then interspersed with very specific events and specific thoughts that meant something to her at that point in her life. Basically the residue of what you remember about living in a place versus your regular schedule of things that happen. So this is the very kind of the beginning of her day, and then at the end of the book you get to the point that she falls asleep. So
having her remember like the summer that she spent in that house and stuff is fantastic, because it's exactly that kind of memory that you just really not wipe up, but you just don't have any cause to remember it. You said something the other night about cartooning, comic books, graphic novels. I never know what to call them.
That's okay. It's we're in sort of a, you know, that's been a problem of cartooning. It's sort of like, you know, I used to really hate the word graphic novelist because I thought it sounded a little pretentious, and as my friend Dan Klaus has pointed out, it makes us sound like pornographers. And I like the word cartoonist because I think it's disarming and unpretentious and has a certain humility to it, but at the same time, graphic novelist has come to sort of mean something now, I think. It implies that the artist is trying to do something somewhat possibly serious, hopefully, and it makes explaining what I do at parties with my daughter's fellow students' parents, you know, a little easier. So
it's better than saying what my grandmother used to call funny books.
Yeah,
that's
true. Yeah, I think that's a good word, though, too. I don't mind that. So I actually, some of those stories in this were serialized in the New York Times in an ill-fated section that they decided to call the funny pages, which, needless to say, I got a number of letters complaining that I was not fulfilling the section's charter. So, well, there's something about, I mean, comics have for decades, centuries, promised a certain emotional response. There's very few art forms that have that expectation to them. And I can't really think of anything, actually, where you go to something expecting a very specific emotional response. Maybe stand-up comedy or something, but I don't know. So for a while, it was kind of useful to controvert that expectation as a cartoonist. Now I think it's hopefully been somewhat halfway proven that comics can handle more complicated emotions than that. So. Yeah.
I think that's definitely been the trajectory for the last, 10, 15 years. I still feel guilty about reading comic books sometimes. You know, like I still like, but you were saying the other night, and it made me feel less guilty about my own reading habits, which was, you don't care if people linger, because my friends, you know, they'll buy a Daredevil comic book and they'll linger over every panel and like really pay attention. I can read through one of them in 20 minutes, easy, you know, 15. And you said that's actually, to you, part of the point, like, is that the images, you're getting this information from the images, but you're not actually forcing people to look at them. Seriously, did I understand that correctly?
No, that's right. I mean, I don't. Yeah, I can't be over somebody's shoulder and take the book out of their hand and say, you were looking at that picture for too long, but I can. I hope that I can do a drawing that is not interesting enough, that lingering on it will not be a particularly rewarding experience, so that you will continue on. To me, that would be tantamount to pausing a symphony on a particular note and just listening to a note for a while or something. That's not the idea. The idea is how the experiences accumulate in sort of a rhythmic, melodic way in the mind, I guess. If you think of drawing as a way of seeing, drawings are meant to be looked at and comics are meant to be read. The drawings in comics are not necessarily drawing. It's sort of the difference between singing and speaking. They're related, but they're not the same thing.
Chris Ware, everybody. The book is called Building Stories. It's available everywhere. All of his graphic novels are amazing. Do go and dip into them. You can find them everywhere, including your local library, where I've happily borrowed a few of them. And while you're dipping into things, if you want to hear about a new novel or hear another discussion, get a top 10 list of crime novels, all sorts of content and resources are available on our website, which is scottishbooktrust.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at ScottishBKTrust, or go ahead and just like us on Facebook. All you have to do is click that thumbs up button, and you'll be getting all of the new up-to-date news about books from across Scotland and the world. Chris Ware's book, Building Stories, is very much about narrative and how we kind of tell the stories of our lives. And actually, Dilys Rose has a new novel out, which is works along a quite similar theme, and I was really pleased to talk to her about it. Her novel is out now from Lewith Press, and we sat down to talk to her about it. It's called Pelmanism.
I'm Dilys Rose, and my novel's called Pelmanism.
So for people who don't know, what is Pelmanism? I guess both the novel and the intriguing game.
Okay, the game was designed in the late 19th century by the Pelman Institute as an aid to memory. So what happens is you put out a whole set of cards face down, and you try and find pairs. So as the game goes on, there are gaps in the deck as you take the pairs off. So it gets easier as it goes on. So it's about remembering where certain cards were, picking them up, and getting a clear board eventually.
I think there's a game called Guess Who, which is very similar, which was with faces, wasn't it?
Yeah, my kids used to play that. We liked that game with little pop-up faces on it. Same idea, pairs, yeah.
So let's get into the novel. What's the novel about, and how does this game affect the novel?
It's literal and it's metaphorical. The game is played in the novel. Gala plays it with her grandmother at one point. Her grandmother and her old lady friends enjoy games of cards. The novel is about memory and its holes, its gaps, its unreliability. The place it came from was an image, a memory of somebody diving through a ring of fire. I don't know whether I actually saw this happen or whether I didn't see it happen. I've come across this happening quite a lot, particularly when I talk to either family or friends about things we've done together, that our memories of an occasion can be very different. So I wanted to use that as a way of exploring a story, to try and work out, you know, the real memory, because actually I'm not sure there is such a thing. I think once you start remembering, you start inventing as well.
Because that accounts, I guess, in a way, for the decision to make it a very, like a series of interconnected short stories and fragmented short stories rather than one sustained long narrative, I guess.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think I wanted things to be in sort of relatively discrete scenes, like memories. I mean, sometimes the memories I have tend to be kind of isolated. They don't have a kind of before and after necessarily. The book does have a before and an after, and it does have a direction, but it's kind of composed of scenes which can be, to a certain extent at least, taken on their own. Yeah. And so I did write the younger section of Gala's life, first of all, and then I wrote the older section, and then I began to shuffle them around and to find a way in which a pattern could emerge.
I like the idea of them being shuffled around like a pack
like
of cards.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting that the idea of, because I think memory, especially when it comes to like family and this relationship that she's having with her father, mm. and the trouble, I guess, in a way, a very troubled relationship at times. And that is one of the weirdest things, that like when you're eight, and the way you come back to a memory is one of the strangest things about getting older, I find. Like realizing that your parents were human beings, or they must have been going through this trouble. Or there's that scene that you write about where her father is, I think, drawing life models, nudes, and can't understand why he would want to do that, or how that's happening. It was really, really elegantly done. And then, of course, with age, you begin to unpack some of these questions.
Yes, as a child, you take things in, but you understand them in a very different way. So the Gala that's in the story is actually looking back. She's not writing it as if she was a child at the time. She's writing it at a different point and trying to make sense of the memories, I think. Trying to, I suppose, construct another narrative than the one that she might have constructed when she was a child.
And I guess that, like, yeah, that changes over time. What you realize your family actually is, as opposed to what the presentation of your family is to the outside world, and even internally, changes.
It does, absolutely. And as you get older, as you become a parent, you have a different relationship, a different idea about what parenthood is, different relationship with and to your own parents. And yes, I think it's in constant flux. It's never really the same, which is strange, because when we think of identity, or when I think of identity, I kind of think, well, there's a core of me that's always been the same. It's never really changed. But I'm not quite sure how true that is now, or what it means, whether it's just that there's something that's the same, but it's always in flux.
And does it matter if a story, like we're going, kind of going back to that idea of misremembering things or remembering certain images that you didn't even actually see or that you maybe dreamed, does it matter that you didn't, that those didn't happen, that those aren't actual memories, if you still feel them? Does that make a difference?
We have to decide the difference between whether something is fiction and whether it's autobiography. And as fiction, I think I naturally change things as they go along for the needs of the story, rather than to try and recreate what actually happened. And I'm not sure that, I think I would find it impossible to write a straight memoir, because my natural desire is to change things and to shape them in the writing. When I write, that's what I do, I change things.
Yeah, so it hits an emotional truth rather than a literal, this is what happened. And I think memoirists also do that.
Yeah, I agree. I think memoirs are as inventive and fictional, perhaps, as novels can be. And I think autobiography, too, is perhaps not suspect, but questionable in terms of its veracity. Mm. Because apart from anything, you're never going to tell the whole truth. You're always going to select. You couldn't tell the whole truth. There isn't time. So you will select the parts which make sense, make a particular sense, or make a particular coherent story, perhaps in a very similar way to the way in which a novelist works.
And of course, that's the way we do it in our own heads, right? Like you talk about an above former relationship or something, and it's got a very nice, neat narrative that it didn't have at the time.
No, exactly.
Like, and then this happened, and then this happened. And it's a really interesting thing to look at and to examine, especially in the realm of fiction, as opposed to doing it like memory as a nonfiction. There's a great book there to be had about memory as nonfiction, but like to look at it as a fiction book is really interesting. I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about the way the book starts with a poem to R.D. Lang.
Well, that's interesting because initially I had wanted to use one of R.D. Lang's notes because I think they're really interesting and they do have relevance to the story because R.D. Lang was working in the area in the 60s, very close to the area in which the story is set. But there were copyright issues and we ran out of time in getting clearance. And I really wanted something of that sort at the beginning because I felt I need to set up this sort of mind game that Lang plays in the notes. So the only way I could do this was to write my own one as a homage to him. And actually, I think what I wrote makes more sense. It's more particular to the story in question than some of Lang's ones, which were very interesting, and I love going back to them, but a little bit more generic. I think what it sets up is this: the atmosphere of everybody kind of circling around each other and restraining themselves, keeping things back. So homage to R.D. Lang. Whatever they do, they must not, no matter what, let him know they think something's not right. Whatever they know, they must not, no matter what, let him think they know something's not right. Whatever they think, they must not, no matter what, let him know they know something he doesn't.
Dillis Rose, everybody. The book is Pelmanism. You can find it at fine bookstores everywhere. And of course, it's available online for you to purchase. Really a pleasure to talk to her about the book, Pelmanism. I never even knew that game existed. And lastly, we have Michael Fry. Michael Fry is a historian. Of course, we've been talking on this podcast today about stories and how stories are told and how they're remembered. And he's got a new book called A New Race of Men, Scotland, 1815 to 1914. And it's a really particularly interesting time in Scottish history, which Michael explains very elegantly. And I was fascinated by it. And I hope you are too.
Michael Fry, and I'm the author of, among other books, A New Race of Men, Scotland, 1815 to 1914. A New Race of Men is actually a reference to one of the descriptions of Scotland that was produced in those years in the New Statistical Account written in the 1840s, where already, I mean, it was actually at an early stage of the transformations that came over Scotland in the 19th century, but already people were absolutely amazed at the progress that had been made. Within the single lifetimes of people, Scotland had gone from being a poor and backward country to, not yet to one of the most advanced countries in the world, but it was certainly enriching itself at a prodigious rate, at a rate which people had never imagined. So they asked themselves, well, how is this all coming about? The Scots have a reputation for being rather a conservative people, or even stick in the mud. They're attached to their old ways, their agricultural life, living in cottages with runrig as their system of agriculture and their attachment to the old ways of their people. So how is this all coming about? And so some of them said, well, it must be a new race of men who are producing this new Scotland somehow out of the various forces at work in our history. We're producing something in Scotland which has never been known before, simply judging that by the extremely rapid rate of progress. So they ask themselves, well, what are the qualities of these people who are managing to produce this stupendous transformation in a country which always appeared to everybody else to be so unpromising, so infertile, so grey and forbidding?
What was it that happened at that time? What was that shift that occurred?
Perhaps one of the main facts about Scottish history was that Scotland united with England in 1707. All kinds of opportunities were opened on that bigger stage, as it were, that bigger theatre for Scottish talents. But nevertheless, I don't think they would have been exploited unless the Scots really had certain talents. So, first of all, Presbyterian religion basically you're all damned, but you can save yourself if you work hard and follow the Ten Commandments and really set yourself to making a success of your life. And it's up to you, Jimmy or Jenny. There's no use running to a priest or a church to ask them to save you. You have to do it yourself. And if you do it yourself, then you can save yourselves from this miserable existence. You can enrich yourselves and you can live a good life. Then the second thing was that the Scots already had an excellent education system. The Scottish education system was not a system for an elite. It went on the principle that we can educate the whole people, not perhaps to the highest level, but we can bring them up to a standard where they can take charge of their own destiny and start to improve themselves. And this was the basic principle of Scottish education. Third thing was, I think you can say, the general Scottish culture, which was a democratic culture, but with the idea behind it that everyone can succeed in life. You can start off from being a poor man and you can end up a rich man. And if you look, for example, what happened to Scottish industry in the 19th century, where Scotland rose from nothing to, for example, to become the greatest shipbuilder in the world, also one of the greatest producers of iron and steel, coal mining. In that society built around those industries, there was no real distinction of boss and worker. Everyone started off as an apprentice, and then some people were brainier or more skilled or more hardworking than others, and they rose then in life and grew rich and founded companies which gave employment to other people. Yet they never felt a huge social difference between those and the others who had been left behind as ordinary workers in the shipyards. And the people left in the shipyards never felt resentment against those who improved their position in life. They just said, oh, that guy is brainier, or that guy works harder. But they were all still one people. There was a stupendous social unity which allowed the whole nation to advance without the huge class differences opening up that so often hindered the development of other nations, or at least, let's say, generated big social problems for the future.
I almost wanted to say it sounds very American, but then that last bit where you're talking about the unity, mm-hmm. I suddenly feel like that didn't quite happen in America. But in terms of like the individuality, yeah, of spirit, of the person, the personal individuality, and yeah, go out and get it, and this notion that you can go from rags to riches.
The difference between America and Scotland was that Scotland was a small and quite closed society. Not many people came from outside to live in Scotland, so what distinguished Scotland was everyone was brought up under the same system with the same values, rather than opening up a huge wide field for everybody. Scotland, as it were, moved as an entity, as a unity, forward. It moved from poverty to riches, and it moved without sacrificing its values. And I think that was something people very much valued, because it meant that it was at the same time quite a conservative society, but also a very progressive society. And it's really, I won't say it's a unique phenomenon in modern history, but it's certainly a rare phenomenon for a society to undergo the huge upheavals of the Industrial Revolution. Industrial Revolution usually atomizes and divides societies, whereas in Scotland the difference was that somehow it managed all to hang together, to cling together, and carry a sense of social equality with it from an old era into a new era.
And is that part of why it was such a surprise to lead someone to say there must have been a new race, because of that unity? Looking at it from the outside, mm-hmm, all of a sudden you looked up once, and then,
well, I think people said we're the same people as we were before, but somehow we're a new race. We're doing something that we didn't do before. It's as if we had been lifted up from one part of the earth and put in another, as the Americans were, but we're doing it in the same place. So maybe we are. We through this magical working of different centripetal forces, we're completely transforming our country. And maybe we're transforming ourselves as well. In that sense, a new race.
It's really interesting because especially like I'm just thinking about the way, you know, Scotland appears from the outside, which is, you know, either nostalgic soaked or whatever. Do you think there's still resonances of that pre-1840 mentality when people look at Scotland or consider it as a place?
The thing is that in the late 19th century, people came from all over the world to learn in Scotland. I mean, students came to the Scottish universities from America and they came from Russia. When the Japanese wanted to start their shipbuilding industry in the 1880s and 1890s, they sent their apprentices to the Clyde. And so it was a centre to which people from all over the world looked for particular skills. I would say the character of Scottish society, despite all these foreign contacts, did not actually change all that much. It remained a conservative society. But in the end, as with all societies, you know, it ran out of steam, market conditions changed, things in the 20th century became much worse than they had been in the 19th century. And then, perhaps, the respect for tradition, the weight of tradition, became a handicap rather than an advantage. In the 19th century, it had certainly helped the society to stick together and achieve more than it would have done otherwise. But from the middle of the 20th century, that probably no longer applied.
I guess, how did you decide to do a whole book on this time and yeah. this issue? What made that click for you?
I wanted to connect the Scotland of the present or of the future with the Scotland of the past. Before 1707, Scotland was an independent country with its own values and its own institutions. And generally, people assume in the 21st century that the Scotland of today has really very little to do with that historic Scotland. The historic Scotland has pretty well disappeared. And left nothing behind. It's just consigned to the dustbin of history. But I wanted to show that there are a lot of threads which lead us from that old Scotland to a new Scotland, if there's going to be one. We don't have to assume that our history has been lost. And, you know, as a historian, I'm interested in showing how our history still matters. People in Scotland have been too unaware of, to begin with, the facts of their history, how those facts hang together, how they have survived, and how they still influence us in the present day.
Thanks, Michael, and thanks to iWrite, where we recorded that in the Mitchell Library in Glasgow. It's always a great time hanging out in the Mitchell Library for me, so really glad we got a chance to do that. And it was a fantastic festival, and we look forward to next year. Thanks again to Michael, and of course, to Dillis Rose and Chris Ware, both of whom are excellent. And I highly recommend that you seek out their books, or really, because this is the Scottish Book Trust podcast, any book will do. It's been lovely weather outside. Take a book to the park. Yeah, that'd be a lovely little date. Bring a blanket and some oranges and apples. So that's all for this episode, so get those earbuds out of your ears and get yourself into a really good book.